This strip of solid rocket propellant can release enough energy to lift your television set 800 feet into the air. To see how this energy will send giant rockets into outer space, stay tuned to Science in Action. Wells Fargo Bank, American Trust Company, proudly brings you Science in Action, now in its 10th year on television, produced by the West's oldest scientific institution, the California Academy of Sciences. This award-winning series is presented each week at this time by Wells Fargo Bank American Trust Company, serving Northern California since 1852. For complete banking service, visit any one of our more than 100 offices throughout Northern California. And now, here's Dr. Earl S. Harold.
As vehicles of exploration, rockets are the key to outer space. As powerful long-range weapons, rockets represent a deterrent force against the horrible devastation that only rockets themselves could cause. This second report on rocket research will tell us something about the substance that gives a rocket its tremendous energy. We'll discover what sort of rocket propulsion sends the Atlas Intercontinental Missile, a distance of 6,000 miles, at speeds up to 5 miles a second. Our guest scientist has been a leader in the field of rocket propulsion since the early 1940s. He is president of the American Rocket Society, professor of aeronautics at Stanford University, and director of professional development at the United Technology Corporation in Sunnyvale, California. It's my pleasure to welcome to Science in Action, Dr. Howard Seifert. How are you, Howard?
Hello, Earl. Thank you. Before we start talking about rockets themselves, Earl, I'd like to recall to the minds of everyone a law that Newton devised many hundreds of years ago, and that is that to every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. This is a principle on which all rockets operate, and I think we might be able to demonstrate it here with this pinwheel. We have down here a little metal arm with two charges on it. I shall try to light both of them and see whether we can get action to equal reaction.
Boy, look at that.
It seems to prove the really point, doesn't it? Action and reaction are equal and opposite.
Howard, you know, when Captain Truax was here some weeks ago, he told us about the engines that you use on rockets. We'd like to find out now about the fuels that you put inside of these engines. I wonder if we could start with this section that we have over here in the next part and find out a little bit about the problems of what goes in here.
This is a typical rocket engine. It has very hot gases in a chamber. These expand out a nozzle and cool off while they're expanding and end up at a high speed and at many thousand degrees cooler. And while they're expanding, they press against the rocket nozzle, making the thrust. It's this reaction that produces the thrust of the nozzle. Now, these gases back here can be produced either by solids or by liquids burning. But whichever type it is, they must have both an oxidizer and a fuel in order to make enough heat and to make the hot gases.
Both an oxidizer and a fuel then in this compartment in the combustion chamber. If you were designing an ideal propellant for a rocket, what are the things now that you would be interested in?
Well, a good propellant ought to have a number of properties. It first of all should give high thrust per pound of propellant. It should be easy to ignite. It should burn steadily without exploding. It should be convenient to handle, not too poisonous. It should be relatively safe, and finally, it shouldn't cost too much.
What kind of oxidizers now do you use in your test work?
Well, among the liquids, the workhorse oxidizers, the first one used in the United States was nitric acid, which we can show here on a chart. This was used with aniline. The second one used most often in the United States and in Germany was liquid oxygen, abbreviated LOX. And just as an example of another very energetic one is liquid fluorine.
Now, with the oxidizer, of course, you have to have a fuel, so let me put down the first one here, aniline.
That's aniline, yes.
And then you have other types I know that are available, alcohol.
Yes, that was used by the Germans in the V-2.
And then the kerosene?
That was used in the Atlas, or still is used in the Atlas.
And finally, hydrogen.
Yes, that's a very energetic propellant.
Well, now, in order to use the oxidizer and the fuels, you have to keep them separate, I gather, and you do have problems in packaging them within the instrument itself. So
yes.
Let's look over here. And earlier today, yes. You spoke of this as being a plumbing diagram. I didn't realize that...
A flow diagram. You keep your propellants in separate containers so they don't react. Then they are pumped up to a high pressure, and when they're at a high pressure, injected into the rocket combustion chamber through an atomizer. The two pumps are driven by a turbine, which in turn is driven by hot gases from a gas generator.
I see that the turbine exhaust comes out of the side here. Could you use this to direct the rocket whichever way you wanted it to go?
As a matter of fact, in the Titan missile, that's exactly what they do. They guide the missile with these gases, but in the Atlas missile, they have a separate little rocket. And we have here a sample of just such a rocket. This is able to move on gimbals like this so that it can point in any desired direction. The propellants come in through an injector here. This is the device that atomizes them.
I was looking at a photograph which shows the way these propellants come out of that, and it seems to break it up into a tremendous stream there.
Yes, then they burn very rapidly at a temperature of about 5,000 degrees in the combustion chamber here and expand out the nozzle.
Well, now, I don't know what kind of metal this is, but it looks very much like a stainless steel, and if I remember, the stainless steels do not have a very high melting point.
They melt at less than 5,000 degrees.
How do you get around that?
So then we must cool them by a liquid on the back surface here. The fuel, the kerosene in this case, is used to keep the metal cool enough that it will not melt.
Oh, down through these little holes that we see up and down in here. Mm-hmm. How much thrust would a small directional motor like this have?
Now, on the Atlas, there are actually a pair of these, and together they give about a quarter of a ton, but the main engine of the Atlas gives 200 tons.
200 tons. The rate of speed at which the gases would be coming out of the jet here, how fast would that be?
Oh, as high as 6,000 miles an hour. They're very fast.
This has to be ignited in order to work, however.
Yes, in this one, a pyrotechnic, that's a black powder type of igniter, is inserted in the nozzle, and this warms them up enough to begin combustion.
You mentioned earlier some types that when brought together, they will ignite by themselves, and you don't have to have the ignition apparatus you have on here.
There is one combination. It's called a spontaneously igniting fuel. As a matter of fact, the pair here, nitric acid and aniline oil, will ignite on contact. The Germans call this hypergolic ignition.
Hypergolic, that sounds like a very good name.
That's quite a mouthful, but we have, as a matter of fact, a sample set up here of these propellants, and Mr. George Peterson of the United Technology Solid Propellant Chemistry Lab will cause combustion to occur here.
Now, George looks like a man from Mars with that protective gear on his face. There,
well, actually, this can be an explosive reaction if it's not handled properly, and it's necessary to be cautious. He has in that little beaker there about a cubic centimeter of red fuming nitric acid, and in the dropper right above it, a few drops of aniline oil. Now, we don't make any positive predictions as to what will happen here. There will be a violent reaction between the two, and it may indeed burst into a flame. Let's see what happens. Now, it decided not to give a large flame, but you can see that there's a strong reaction, and under the conditions of a rocket engine, it does indeed burst into flame.
Well, now, with something like this, then, you require no ignition system. It will merely ignite when you bring the two of them
together.
That's
right.
Why can't this be used more widely?
Well, as a matter of fact, other propellants give more thrust, and people are willing to pay the price of an ignition system in order to get better performance. Liquid oxygen and alcohol or kerosene is such a combination.
You know, I was looking in your book here. In fact, I was reading some of these things here, and I found that there was a great deal of difference between the way in which the liquid fuels that we've just been talking about and the solid fuels react. Space technology. Howard, could we go into some of the aspects of the solid fuels?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we have over here a large-scale model of a solid rocket engine, and let's take a look at it and see how solids differ from liquids.
No, I was amazed at the small amount of equipment that you have here. Practically nothing at all compared with what you've diagrammed over there on the liquid system.
It's very much simpler. It doesn't have a plumbing system, and it doesn't have the valves and tanks. As a matter of fact, all there is to a solid engine is this rather thin-walled container, which is stressed right up to the limit. The propellant itself, which is represented by this lighter colored area here in a cylindrical form, and a hollow space for the gas to escape, and an igniter.
Now, what do you put inside of this igniter? How does it work?
That's a kind of a plastic basket with things like black powder in it, and these are ignited electrically. And then they make hot gases that sweep down the charge and ignite the surface.
Let's see, and then when it comes out the nozzle here, the nozzle provides the impetus, and I guess would also provide the directional elements here.
Well, yes, in this case, the nozzle does not move, but one thing that is true about the nozzle is that the heat transfer is very high, and this throat to the nozzle has to be built of graphite or molybdenum or some very refractory material, otherwise it will melt.
I know you've spoken of the material inside here as being of a rubbery consistency. Something
yes.
That is rather
bouncing
in nature.
Earl, how would you like a little package of free energy here?
Is this free energy? This is the sort of thing that you'd use
free.
In this?
Yes, that's the propellant.
So this then contains the both the oxidizer and the fuel.
That particular chunk is 80% oxidizer. That may seem like a lot, but actually only part of the oxidizer molecule can enter the reaction, and that's why such a large proportion. It starts out with oxidizer particles mixed with a liquid fuel, and then it sets up into a rubber.
How much energy could you get from this?
That particular chunk would release 10,000 BTUs of heat. That's the same as 8 million foot-pounds. That would toss a one-pound piece of iron about 50 miles.
That much. I wonder if we could go to your laboratories and find out how you would produce material like this strictly on an experimental basis.
All right, let's take a look in the laboratory at the small-scale processing of some solid propellants. Here is a gentleman who is getting oxidizer ready to be ground. First, he puts it through a sieve to get out the large particles. And after the big particles have been taken out, it's put through a grinder, shown here, to make it into very fine particles. It's necessary that the size of these be carefully controlled and that they be ground down to about a micron in size. Then he puts it into a mixer where it joins the liquid fuel and is very, very thoroughly mixed, particles of oxidizer and liquid fuel. And after a considerable mixing process, a sample is taken off to see if it has the right properties.
You would test the sample then before going further with it?
Normally, yes, if it's going to be a propellant that's cast into a large engine. In this laboratory scale, they're taking a sample, and in the next shot that you see, they will place the case of the rocket engine at the exit there and pour directly into the case of the rocket engine. I think now that he is preparing to do this, there is a mandrel, sort of a rod down the center of the case, and the propellant flows around this, and after it sets up, why, there's a hollow space in the center.
Inert materials all the way through there. I noticed that those are plastics and special valves that he's using there.
Yes, it's necessary to be very careful that no sparks or any hazards of that kind are produced. He's looking now with a flashlight to see that the thing's flowing in properly. And now the whole charge is going to be heated for a couple of days at something above body heat. And during that time, which is called the curing period, it sets up into this rubber that you have in your hand here. And after it is cured, the mandrel, the center tube, is withdrawn. And we then have the complete rocket ready to go except for the nozzle.
But the material, that is, in other words, the propelling material, which would be this same material here, that was still inside, and
yes.
If we looked at this
here, it's attached to the wall, it's bonded to the wall, as a matter of fact, glued on.
Well, now, this, I gather, might be made through the laboratory procedure we just saw, but how would you make enough to fill a container of this size, or perhaps even larger?
Well, this could be done a couple of different ways. In one of this, literally this size, you could pour it in one single batch by appropriate machinery. Or perhaps a better way to do it would be to put it in segments. That is, like building blocks or bricks in a wall. You would put in a section at a time and glue them together.
This would give you the chance to inspect each section and have a more reliable product.
Howard, I gather it's perfectly safe to handle this, but I'm not sure I understand about the rate of burning. Does this, when it starts to burn, is it fast?
It would explode. It better not explode.
Well, thank you, sir.
the rate of burning inside the rockets may be an inch or less per second, and when you burn it out in the atmosphere, it burns even more slowly. Mr. Peterson has a sample over here of this propellant, and I think he can show us how it burns. There you have it.
If you blow on that, what would happen?
It will not go out. You have to dunk it in the water to get it to go out. Even then, it doesn't want to go out. It burns underwater.
It still burned underwater,
yes.
And I guess that was due to the fact that it has the oxygen within itself.
Yes, it has its own oxygen.
I want to ask you a rather leading question, if I may. I gather there are two fields of thought. There are the liquid fuel people, and then there are the solid people. Now, are you in the liquid camp, or are you in the solid camp?
Well, I'm not in either camp right now. I worked with liquid rockets for many years, but it's turning out now that both liquids and solids can be used for any application very nearly. For a long time, only liquids could do large rocket jobs, but now both. As a matter of fact, the upper stages of most of the satellites have been solid rockets, and now even the boosters are beginning to be designed from solid rockets.
Howard, can we stray for a moment from professional rocketry? Every week we pick up the paper, and some youngster has been conducting an experiment.
Yes, one just yesterday.
Right. And something very disastrous happens. Now, as president of the American Rocket Society, I know you have very definite views on this.
I do. I have strong feelings about youngsters experimenting with rockets. I certainly admire and respect their enthusiasm, but they do not have the proper equipment or the proper information to do this safely. So when you find them building something like this, for instance, out of an old piece of pipe, they're doing something very hazardous. When you consider, for example, that this .38 caliber cartridge with about a half or a quarter of an ounce of propellant has enough energy to kill a man at 1,000 yards, you can imagine what this thing with a pound or so of the same energy substance in it can do under the wrong circumstances.
How much force would there be in this homemade rocket?
Well, a great deal. For example, I have a picture here of an explosion of a rocket, not much larger than this, and what it did to the concrete test stand. There is the concrete that from which it was tested, and the pieces of the rocket itself can be seen in the next picture. That's what happens to half-inch thick steel pipe when the propellant does the wrong thing.
Well, even the spectators who might be quite a distance away, they still run a hazard from operation of something like this.
Yes, they need protection, and I have a remarkable photograph here of some amateurs launching a rocket without protection. This was an unsuccessful flight, and they were directly in line of fire. Even if they'd been behind sandbags, they still wouldn't have been safe because the particles come down from above.
Well, now, assuming that you were fortunate enough to have a successful launching of something like this, you still can't tell where it's going to go.
Their flight is very erratic. It can come down through someone's roof or damage a person or property, and it's just generally unsafe.
Howard, what would you recommend for a youngster who has a true interest in rocketry? What should he do?
Well, there are many things he can do. He can experiment with compressed gas devices, or he can study the physics and astronomy of the subject. He can buy propulsion models, and or he can experiment with some of the types shown here. Now, this is a citric acid bicarbonate rocket, and Mr. Peterson has charged it up, and I got this.
Boy, that really went
up. I think this proves my point about the erratic flight of amateur rockets. So this was a professional rocket, you might say.
But things of this kind, in other words, one shouldn't attempt to build his own charges and to build something like
absolutely
this, which would be very, very dangerous.
Any youngsters who want to hear about or learn more can depend on the help of the members of the American Rocket Society. There are 15,000 of them now, and they will be glad to answer any questions.
Well, then, anyone who should write in to Science in Action in care of the station, we could send that to you as president of the Rocket Society, and they would receive a communication
from
your
committee that will help them and send them information.
Fine. Well, I'm very glad to know that. Howard, by way of summation, could you give us your viewpoint on the future? What may we expect in this field? Are there marvelous developments just around the corner?
Well, the chemical rocket propellants are being pretty well exploited, and they can do most of the things that we need to do in the military sense. They can send a few hundreds of pounds into orbit. If we get to the point where we want to send many tons into orbit or several tons to the moon, then it'll be necessary to have a more energetic propellant, and I believe that this means nuclear energy or even electric propulsion. By electric propulsion, I mean the acceleration of electrons the way they are done in a television tube.
These are things that we might expect to see within the next 5 or even 10 years?
Well, people are working on them very energetically now, and I sincerely hope they'll succeed in that length of time.
Dr. Howard Seifert, I want to thank you, sir, for coming to Science in Action to tell us about this very interesting field.
Thank you.
J. Jacobus is waiting for us on the other side of the studio. Let's step over and join him.
Our student guest this evening is Trudy Noller from across the bay. Trudy, how old are you and what grade in school are you?
I'm 15 and in the 10th grade.
10th grade where?
Berkeley High School.
Yes, we have that famous picture of your auditorium to look at here. The head of your science department is Mr. Robert Rice, isn't he?
That's right.
He's an old friend of Science in Action. In fact, he's the executive director of the Bay Area Science Fair. Where is he now?
He's in Washington, D.C.
Before that, he was in Ireland, wasn't it?
That's right.
And in a few weeks, he's going to become president of the National Science Teachers Association.
Mm-hmm.
You're certainly a very distinguished leader of your science group over there. What are your interests in school?
Well, I'm vice president of the biology club.
And it was in biology that you got a first prize in this year's Bay Area Science Fair, wasn't it?
That's right.
Let's take a look at what you did. What do you call this?
The biology of the internal parasite Therion californicum.
Therion californicum.
That's right.
Well, you've already told me that's wasps, so I can feel pretty intelligent. What did all of this entail?
Well, it entails the life cycle of this wasp. As you can see up here, there's a wasp stinging a host caterpillar. And after its life cycle, the wasp should emerge out of the host pupa.
Well, now, when the wasp sets the egg in the caterpillar, suppose that egg doesn't hatch. What happens then?
Well, a moth will emerge.
The regular moth that we normally think of coming
from
the caterpillar. Over here you have some drawings that you've made. Now, as I understand it, there's no entomologist in the world that's ever made these kind of drawings before.
That's right, on this wasp.
On this particular wasp.
That's right.
And here you have various temperature controls. How did you go about studying the wasp?
Well, I raised the wasps in this air bath, and the...
The air bath being the entire box, is that the idea?
That's right. Uh-huh. And in each carton, I raised the caterpillars with the potato as the food.
Each caterpillar had the same food?
That's right. This is one of the caterpillars right here.
I see. You don't mind holding him at all? And
yeah.
That caterpillar grew into a wasp.
That's right.
We can see a picture of a male and a female wasp.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them didn't make the wasp hood, though.
No, during the life cycle, I dissected some of them so I could find out the internal stages.
Now, are there more things to do in the study of this?
Oh, the field is wide open. One of the more important things, though, is studying it for biological control. This wasp also stings the harmful cornworm.
And you've drawn a drawing up here of that, the cornworm going in there. That's the cornworm we see when we open up an ear of corn and it's sitting there. That cornworm attacks other things, though.
Yes, it also attacks tomatoes and string beans and cotton plants.
And by biological control, you mean these wasps might be able to cut down on these,
that's
is that correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, that's a lot of information you have for a young girl, just a sophomore in high school. What do you plan to do when you leave high school?
Well, I plan to go to the University of California.
And will you study entomology?
Probably so.
You've certainly got a good start on it. Today, Mr. Harry Albrick, who is the bank's manager of the North Berkeley office, opened a savings account for you and sent along your passbook. There it is, Trudy. We'd like you and your family to have a family membership in the California Academy of Sciences. Thanks very much for being our guest, and good luck to you in the future.
Thank you.
A student guest this evening was Trudy Noller from Berkeley High School. Now, it may come as a surprise to you to find out that last year, 13 billion checks were drawn by individuals and business firms in this country. Not only that, the rate at which checks are drawn is increasing by a billion or two every year. Now, that's pretty convincing evidence that more and more people are getting in the habit of paying all of their bills by check. They're beginning to realize that a checking account is one thing in life they just can't do without. And that's why I'd like to remind you once again of the advantages of having your checking account at Wells Fargo Bank American Trust Company. First, your money is in the bank. There's no need to carry large amounts of cash around with you, and that lessens the danger of loss. Second, a checking account is convenient, for you can pay most of your bills from the comfort of your own home. What's more, when income tax time comes once again, those canceled checks are an excellent record of all of your expenditures. At Wells Fargo American Trust, we have a checking account to fit your particular needs. There's our regular checking account for those who require unlimited checking privileges, and our special checking account for those who need write only a few checks each month. You purchase the special checks as you need them, and no minimum balance is required. Tomorrow, why not visit the nearest office of Wells Fargo Bank American Trust Company and open your checking account. And now let's return to Dr. Harold and his animal of the week.
I've just been stroking the head of our animal of the week, which happens to be a toucan, a very, very strange type of bird from the tropical forests of the Americas. Norman Blanchett has brought over from Fruitvale Pet this exotic bird. And, Norm, I want to ask you a little bit about the how these birds do in captivity. Are they good pets?
Very, very easily taken care of, Earl. They eat fruits and very gentle, as you can see this one is.
I don't know whether he's interested in food or not. You know, the size of the bill here would lead one to believe that this was quite heavy. It doesn't feel that way, though. I can't tell very much from the weight from this.
Actually, it only weighs 1 ounce, and you can imagine that it would have to be of a lightweight construction in order for the bird to fly. And these birds can actually fly like the wind.
Bright yellow on this part, and then it shades into green over here, and brilliant blue around the eye, a white breast. What kind of a toucan is this one, Norm?
This is a white-throated toucan. It's not as common a bird as you'll see around. The sulfur-breasted is the more common of the two.
It looks very much like some of the South African hornbills, which are noted for the fact that they seal the female during nesting season into a tree trunk. These, I gather, are not related, however.
No, not at all, Earl.
Very, very beautiful bird. What do you call him?
This bird's name is Cyrano.
Ah, very, very appropriate.
It is.
Have you received a lot of comments on, this week has been Be Kind to Animals Week.
Right, Earl. And we would wish that the remaining 51 weeks of the year would be adhered to as closely as this one.
Thanks very much for bringing you over, Serrano.
Thank you.
Next week on Science in Action, a special program having to do with modern food science. Our guest will be Dr. Ray B. Wakefield, who is the president of the Institute of Food Technologists of America. We look forward to seeing you 1 week from this time. Thank you very much for being with us.
You have just seen program number 387 in the award-winning television series Science in Action, produced by the California Academy of Sciences under the supervision of its director, Dr. Robert C. Miller. Brought to you by Wells Fargo Bank American Trust Company as a public service to the many communities served by its more than 100 banking offices. Until next Monday at 7, good evening.